You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I want to thank you all for joining us this Friday morning. I know in the season of holiday parties, sometimes it can be hard to drag oneself out of bed. But I think we have a very interesting discussion lined up today. It's a topic that is both very popular in the media, but at the same time doesn't get a lot of very serious discussion. Anonymous in the related phenomenon of hacktivism has inspired an incredible amount of fear. I know inside this particular institution there was a decent amount of concern that we might be exposing ourselves to some sort of risk because a lot of the media reports are genuinely terrifying. This seems to be this force from out in the ether that can come and prey on anyone at any time. They have visuals that are certainly resonant of many popular media themes. They have a creepy computer voice, and they seem to be everywhere. At the same time, there are many people who are tempted to dismiss some of the phenomena that we see. Every generation has some sort of antisocial behavior that people decry. Bill Buford's famous book, Among the Thugs, talks about hooliganism, and at the time, everyone in England was afraid that it was going to destroy civic society. And there's a natural reaction among some of the people who've been doing IT for a while that every time the media talks about something new in IT, they're going to overreact. See, for example, sexting. But there is, I think, quite a bit to talk about and understand in the phenomena of digital hacktivism and vigilantism. There is some power on the technical side. The attacks take advantage of social phenomena, of crowdsourcing. They use tools that are shared by others, in some cases, denial of service attacks. The model of doxing, or releasing massive amounts of public information about individuals, is certainly disturbing to many people and many companies. And as we look at it, several things are apparent. First, much of the power that we see comes from the open nature of the information technology world. We don't regulate how to design a website. We don't enforce clear models of what upstream providers have to do. And public and private information is easily available about all of us everywhere. So this is part of the ecosystem that we live in. Similarly, anonymous as a phenomenon, I think, really deserves to be studied, if for no other reason than it's a fascinating self-organizing system. Online association and collective action has been something that people have talked about since the beginning of IT and have talked about the challenges of pseudonymous and anonymous communication in terms of building a community. This one seems to have accomplished some amount of collective action. And at the same time, it's also clear that a world with multiple groups who are happy to engage in their own agenda at the expense of law and order, at the expense of other people's private property, at the expense of other people's systems, is not a very stable model that we want to look into. So as policymakers and as scholars, we need to explore that and understand what the long-term trajectory is going to be. To do that today, we have a fantastic panel. We'll be starting off with Professor Gabriella Coleman, who is an assistant professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University, soon to move up to McGill University. And she's an anthropologist by training. Her first book, Coding Freedom, is about the online associations and models inside the free software community and how you have community and cooperation and collective action in that community. She has since been working on, among other aspects, understanding the anonymous world and has spent a lot of time talking to people involved and studying them as an anthropologist, as an ethnographer, to understand what's going on in that community. On the technical side, to tell us a little bit about some of both the attack models and defense approaches that we can have, we have Richard Forno, who is the graduate, the director of the graduate program of cybersecurity at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And is the co-founder of Maryland Cyber Challenge and Conference. He's also a visiting scientist at the Software Engineering Institute at CMU. He has a long and storied career in IT and computer security, and was one of the first people to seriously study information warfare as a new phenomenon in the information age, and has written a book on information, the art of information warfare, and also incident response. Finally, to give us some understanding of the policy side and the law enforcement approach, we have Paul Rosenzweig, who is the founder of Red Branch Law and Consulting. He's also a fellow at the Heritage Foundation and a professional lecturer at George Washington University Law School. He formerly served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy in the Department of Homeland Security and twice as Acting Assistant Secretary for International Affairs, where he was deeply engaged in understanding development of policy and strategic plans in a variety of national security activities, including things related to IT. So with that, I'd like to welcome Gabrielle Coleman to tell us a little bit about her life among the hackers.
Well, thank you so much, Alan, for inviting me here today. It's actually really exciting to be able to talk to a slightly different audience than I normally talk to, which also presented some challenges because I wanted to maybe give you a picture of Anonymous that you may not be getting in the media, for example. But I also just want to cover some basic ground. So I've kind of compiled a short little presentation that gives some history, but then also gets at some kind of analytical questions that I think are kind of interesting and important as we maybe discuss some more some policy questions during the panel. So I'm going to just jump right in. All right. So Anonymous is by nature, as well as design, difficult to define. It's a name employed by dispersed individuals, some small groups of hackers, technologists, geeks, system administrators, human rights activists, a cluster of both ideas and ideals adopted by these individuals to organize collective actions online and in the real world. Some are fearsome, others are trivial pranks. Some interventions have saved lives in the Middle East region. In recent months, Anonymous has continued to show its face in a range of very unlikely places, from an audacious announcement to take down the seemingly invincible Mexican drug cartels to its constant presence in the Occupy movements. Anonymous seems everywhere and yet notoriously difficult to pin down, and they've made my life as an anthropologist very difficult at times. Their actions are alternatively peaceful and legal, illicit and disruptive. Oftentimes they exist in a moral gray zone, as Anonymous has famously deployed disruptive tactics and illegal ones, such as the distributed denial of service attacks, for the sake of making political claims. Many of these characteristics of Anonymous have much to do with its origins on 4chan, which has become an immensely popular and iconic message board since its launch in 2003. It's been described by one of my colleagues as the single most offensive human artifact in human history, so I take no responsibility if you decide to go there. You might have to make an appointment with your therapist afterwards. Composed of 50 topic-based forums ranging from anime to travel, 4chan is widely perceived to be one of the most offensive quarters on the Internet, teeming with pornography. Next to nothing is sacred there, participants communicating in a language that seems to have reduced English to a bevy of vicious epithets, shocking to outsiders, but among insiders, taken as the normal state of affairs, indeed one of its defining and endearing qualities. Today, Anonymous is nearly synonymous with a very irreverent brand of activist politics. But before 2008, the moniker was used exclusively by people from 4chan for staging fearsome pranks, in internet parlance, trolling. While trolling has often been the purview of boastful cliques such as the exploits of Weave, who's a hacker who's the president of a group called the GNAA, which is an extremely offensive trolling group. On 4chan, trolling is largely crowdsourced, and participants are strongly discouraged from identifying themselves. Because of all the trolling to come rolling out of 4chan, in 2007, Fox News dubbed Anonymous the Internet Hate Machine, which Anonymous embraced, ironically. And then shortly thereafter, in response to this Fox News segment, it released a grim, parodic video describing itself as the face of chaos, harbingers of judgment, those who laugh at the face of tragedy. 6 months after the release of this video, some Anons took this trolling namesake to organize more strident forms of protest. This surprising metamorphosis is what prompted my ethnographic study of Anonymous in 2008, the year they launched what they would describe as an epic win when they trolled the Church of Scientology. In the course of a few weeks, these events, these trolling events against the Church of Scientology, which took the form of sending unpaid pizzas, pranking Dianetic hotlines, sending nude fax body parts to the church, these events took a dramatic U-turn and came to include earnest street protests. Anonymous shifted its tactics, disseminating incriminating facts about Scientology, forging bonds with an earlier generation of dissidents, and focusing in on issues of censorship and human rights abuses. A spout of trolling had thus given birth to an activist endeavor by the name of Project Chanology. And it was really interesting because this shift occurred quite accidentally, and you see this all the time with Anonymous. People had released a video. One of the videos by the name of Hello Leaders of Scientology was just done for the fun of it. It was not a kind of serious video. It was a call to arms to dismantle the Church of Scientology, but it prompted a discussion on internet chat rooms where people asked, huh, maybe we should, in fact, protest the church in earnest. So the video was made for what's called the LULZ, L-U-L-Z. These four letters are a bastardization and pluralization of laugh out loud, and it denotes the pleasures derived from generating things like internet memes, which might be very playful cats with insensible captions, to more fearsome pranks. So compelling was this video that they decided to organize street demonstrations. And on February 10, 2008, thousands of Anons and supporters hit the streets in cities across North America, Europe, and Australia for a worldwide day of action against Scientology. 6 months after being labeled the Internet hate machine by Fox News, Anonymous had legions of followers in the real world, not just geeks and hackers typing at their keyboards, who were seizing on the group's name, its ethic of anonymity, and iconography. Project Chanology thus marked the genesis of a distinct political sensibility, one that cannot be reduced either to just their trolling nor their ardent free speech commitments. It's important to note at the time that Project Chanology took off, the name was still being used by people on 4chan to troll. 2 years later, Anonymous became even more widely known and came to be more widely thought of as an activist entity as a result of a different network by the name of Anonop. So this is a whole different group of people on a different IRC network who coordinated what you may have heard, Operation Payback, also known as Operation Avenge Assange, which was launched to paralyze the website of the financial institutions refusing to transfer funds to WikiLeaks from donors. In the ensuing months, I became shackled to my computer. That was in December 2010. And thankfully, I was on sabbatical, as this germinal operation gave rise to dozens and dozens of additional Anon-Ops political endeavors, from Op Malaysia, which enabled citizens to bypass government filtering, to providing daily technology assistance to activists in the Middle East and African revolutions. Those operations in particular were dubbed the Freedom Operations. Then, in February 2011, came one of their most famous operations, Operation H.B. Gary. Aaron Barr, the CEO of the security firm, claimed to have pwned Anonymous, claimed to have uncovered the identity of key operatives. In response, and in 48 hours, Anons hacked Barr's Twitter account and spewed the most kind of offensive racial slurs possible in 140-character limits. They had him follow the Holy Trinity of Hitler, Gay Pride, and Justin Bieber. They hacked H.B. Gary's servers. They downloaded 70,000 emails, gutted the files. Then they wiped out his iPad and iPhone for good measure. They published the company's data alongside Barr's private communications. And this was done purely for the sake of trolling, for retaliation. But during the process, they uncovered a document, the WikiLeaks threat, which outlined how H.B. Gary Federal and other security companies might undermine WikiLeaks by submitting fake documents to their site. There was also evidence of plans to ruin the careers of supporters of WikiLeaks, among them Glenn Greenwald from Salon.com. It was only a small crew of hackers within Anonops who had started this kind of retaliatory trolling event and ended up exposing what was a kind of COINTELPRO-like proposal. And basically what happened And again, this happens so much with Anonymous. They do something, they discover something, and all of a sudden they decide to go forward with a new type of intervention. Because previous to this, Anonymous had rarely hacked to expose security flaws and access politically sensitive information, preferring to deface and disable websites, along with their legal human rights tech activism. The success of H.P. Gary, and especially its kind of colossal media attention it received, launched new wings of Anonymous dedicated to disclosure of documents, dedicated to exposing security flaws by doing illegal hacking. Okay, so that's a little bit of a sort of overview of where they came from, and just I want to finish off by making a few kind of more conceptual points. There's still a lot more that I didn't obviously cover, so don't take that as, you know, the only thing Anonymous has done. So as a result of the actions just described, Anonymous has been generally misunderstood, described by news reports alternatively as kind of freedom fighters, online activists, or vigilantes. Given what I just told you, the nature of this confusion is not hard to understand. Because beyond a foundational commitment to anonymity and the free flow of information, Anonymous has no consistent philosophy nor political program. Though Anonymous has increasingly devoted its energies over time towards digital dissent and direct action marshaled in the service of political causes, it has no definite trajectory, and its political sensibilities are still drawn by the collective will towards pranking, transgression, and mischief. Even as Anonymous has moved away from pure trolling and 4chan, the underlying character of Anonymous is still intimately connected to kind of lulzy joking and mischievous pranking common to the culture of online message boards. And some of their kind of political actions are still motivated by this kind of prankish sensibility. Thus, if one term embodies the paradoxical and contradictory character of Anonymous, which is now made up of committed activists and agents of mischief or mischievous activists, it is the lulls. The spirit of the lulls, however, is not particular to Anonymous, the internet trolling, nor our times. There have been other groups in the past, such as the Dadaists, the Yippies, and the Yes Men, who've shared a kind of similar rowdy disposition where you fuse pranksterism with activism. But these groups, as opposed to Anonymous, were conceived from the start as radical political enterprises who were also quite vanguardist in their composition. You know, they weren't, you know, allowing kind of hordes of people to join up. Thus, what sets Anonymous apart is its fluid membership and structure and its organic political evolution. And so within the activist expressions of Anonymous, you have order, disorder, you have serious protests in the lulls, you have legal and illegal tactics. And they kind of coexist to ensure a kind of fiery storm of interventions that will make some people inspired to follow suit, others smile, some cry, and leave many wondering who and what lies beneath the mask. Which is to say that Anonymous follows a logic of its own. Partly because of its maverick image and lulzy antics, the group has secured constant media attention, along with a considerable number of participants, as well as a wealth of sympathizers who may not spend hours in chat rooms, but will heed commands to their operations, contribute to DDoS attacks, or circulate messages unfurled on popular anonymous Twitter accounts. They've developed a loose structure, with technical resources such as internet relay chat being run and controlled by a few elites. But these technical elites have erected no formal barriers to membership, such as initiation guidelines or screening processes. Ethical norms tend to be established consensually and enforced by all. The hacking operations are much smaller, much more covert, and far less participatory. But all political operations often come together haphazardly. It's like Anonymous has its finger on the pulse of world events and exploits ones that they think they can intervene in. Despite its unpredictability and the tendency of Anonymous to act in ways that are irreverent, even destructive, vindictive, oftentimes disdainful of the law, Anonymous has seemed to capture a certain prominent zeitgeist. Today, the image and iconography has deeply resonated with many outside of the purview of Anonymous. The icon most associated with them, the Guy Fawkes mask, has come to stand in for a new form of identity, individualism, the promise of human flourishing and betterment in the absence of leaders, and moreover in the absence for the need for individual recognition and fame. And it's become one of the most prominent sort of symbols in the Occupy movements. Across its various faces, Anonymous is configured as e pluribus unum, one out of many, the singularity premise on an anti-celebrity, anti-leader ethic, participants chastising those who seek credit, recognition, and especially celebrity and fame for the labor they put into the collective pot. And so here I'm just giving a little bit of a sense of how they do have some shared ethics and norms across the different kind of faces and networks. The most dramatic example of the importance that Anonymous puts on its kind of anti-celebrity ethic came in real time on IRC when I had posted on one of the channels an article from actually a newspaper that comes out of D.C. That was on Anonymous. And after reading the piece, many participants were just simply indignant that the featured Anon had revealed details about his personal life to the reporter, an infraction made only worse by the fact that this person hadn't really contributed much to some of the political operations. One of the very respected IRC operators, who tend to be more prominent, assessed the situation in one biting sentence. He said, "Attempting to use all the work that so many have done for your personal promotion is not something I will tolerate." A number of Anons then called this person into a different channel, asked him to justify his actions. Unsatisfied with his answers, they ritually killed him off by banning him on this particular server. But it's not simply that within Anonymous, individuality is eradicated in favor of a well-defined group goal. Part of the reason that Anonymous looks the way it does, operations blooming like crazy, as a rhizome or as a hydra, is because individuality flourishes among Anons. It is part of the reason for which Anonymous is also riven by strife and tensions, especially between the different networks. Few of the Anons in Project Chinology who continue to protest the Church of Scientology were fans of the distributed denial of service attacks that Anonops had launched in support of WikiLeaks, for example. The Anonops network thinks that the Project Chinology operations are too small and narrow to be effective. The hacking to leak operations brought other tensions to surface due to the fact that these hacking endeavors, by necessity, had to be conducted secretly on a network that values open participation. But even if Anons don't always agree about what's being carried out under the rubric of Anonymous, and they do argue a lot about it, they tend to respect the fact that anyone can assume the moniker. That's really where what they really value. To conclude, Anonymous sits at the cusp of spectacular visibility thanks to the media and intense individual invisibility. They are evasive, shifty, and nomadic. Their visibility is secured by the lulls, for better or for worse, via pranks, via these hacks, and the lulls securing some of the most audacious, irreverent, and scary interventions. The symbolism of anonymity in their anti-leader ethic has circulated far and wide and seemed to have kind of captured the imagination of other activists around the world. However, in many other respects, they are invisible, intractable, they're spectral. Anons camouflage their identity, although to different degrees and for different purposes. Since some Anons engage in illegal actions, they use it tactically for defensive purposes. Most all Anons, even those that engage in only legal and peaceful protests, also conceal identity for ethical reasons, as I discussed. As a whole, they shun individual celebrity and fame. Thus, at the very same time they've been made into cause célèbre by the media, and by this I mean a kind of very controversial topic, they themselves are disdainful of the culture of celebrity. To be Anonymous is to be many things, from prankster to hacker to human rights activist to fusions of these. However, they sublimate signs and markers of their individuality that otherwise are so commonly offered in every way, place, and form in today's highly networked world of social media, where one is supposed to reveal a constant stream of information about yourself. Whatever we might think of their individual campaigns, Anonymous has thus secured a small oasis of anonymity in this desert of constant bottom-up self-revelation and top-down surveillance. So hopefully that'll give you a little bit of a picture of what they look like from the vantage point of an anthropologist who has spent way too much time on internet relay chat with them over the last year. Thank you.
As we go through our talks this morning, if there are any members of Anonymous here and hear us make a mistake, would you raise your hand and correct us, please? We want to make sure we're giving accurate information. Are there any members of Anonymous here? Any members up here? So we heard about the conceptual underpinnings of Anonymous, you know, who they are, what are their motivations. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about how they do it and what we might consider doing about it at an operational level. You hear terms like denial of service, botnets, IRC. How do these all come together, and what does it mean for Anonymous and online activism? Or online vigilantism. Well, a denial of service attack, as simply as the name implies, it knocks another server or network off the internet. It shuts it down. It denies that service. You can do it one against one or many against one. In the case of Anonymous, their preferred method of attack, if you will, is many anons targeting one given target. And then you essentially overload this target with a lot of information, a lot of network noise, and ultimately that target crumbles. Part of the allure of denial of service attacks is the fact that you can acquire large constellations of cyber armies consisting of controlled PCs very cheaply. So, for example, if I'm a member of Anonymous or any non-government group, a terrorist group, or any sort of non-government entity, and I want to cause mischief on the internet for spamming purposes or to make a political statement, I can rent, yes, rent, for a 24-hour period, a constellation, an army of, let's say, 100,000 computers that have been compromised by others. And for that 24-hour period, I can use this constellation of computers that I don't own to do my bidding. And the going rate is pretty cheap, anywhere from $500 to a couple of thousand. And you get this cyber army at your command for the next 24 hours. Pretty impressive, especially when you can harness all these powerful PCs and laptops to target a given website like Church of Scientology or, you know, a MasterCard or a Visa. But at the same time, there are also tools available individually that users, we can download and use to launch our own denial of service attacks or participate in one to show our support. One of the most commonly known tools that's made the rounds in the media the past year or so is a tool with the fun name of Low Orbit Ion Cannon. Sounds very Star Warsy, doesn't it? And this is a free tool, LOIC. You can download it. It's a Windows-based tool. And from this tool, you simply say, I want to attack this target. I want to send this message and tweak a couple of settings and click Go. And you now turn your computer into a directed weapon, sending network traffic against your target of choice. Now imagine tens or hundreds of thousands of people doing the same thing. Same effect, a denial of service. So that's what a denial of service is, and that's generally been the tool of choice, if you will, in many of these anonymous and online vigilante type of events to raise publicity about a given issue, about a given topic. What's the goal, though? What's the goal of using these tools? What's the operational goal? Well, first off, to draw attention to the cause, as Gabrielle said. We want to make a political statement. We're protesting the Church of Scientology, their policy on internet censorship, their policies on whatever. We're protesting MasterCard and Visa's policy of withholding payments to the WikiLeaks Defense Fund. We're making a political statement. You can trace this type of online activism back to the mid-90s with the Electronic Liberation Front and the Mexican Zapatistas and even the Zetas, who did early types of denial of service and website defacements to draw attention to their cause, whatever that might be. In the 90s, it was mostly political. Online activism essentially jumped the shark from traditional real-world activism. Instead of vandalizing a polling station, they would vandalize a website, a political website, and replace the homepage with another message, a political message. So you see how activism moves from the physical world to the online world in the 90s, and now with the collective nature of Anonymous and the nature of internet in general, we take it to a much more distributed level of impact and influence. So you have denial of service attacks as one, probably the most common form of online activism or protest, to make a point. You also have website defacements. the goal being we're going to attack a given website and replace the homepage with something else, our message. So, for example, if Anonymous wanted to take on, I don't know, whitehouse.gov, you go to the White House website one day and you see a Guy Fawkes mask. That's a defacement. That's a political statement. Maybe there's a movie or a message of some sort there, or taunting or teasing or something. That's a message. That's website defacement. Again, in furtherance of a political or social cultural goal. But we also see cases where groups like Anonymous target intellectual property, personal information, corporate information, proprietary data. And that raises a whole different set of questions. And while we hear discussions about, I forget the term Alan used, doc stuffing,
doxing.
Yep. Doxing. I've heard it before, just I drew a blank. Doxing. Most people don't equate doxing with Anonymous or online activism. They equate denial of service attacks with online activism. But doxing is also a form of online activism. But how does this occur? And for me, one of my challenges in talking with media and those who don't necessarily understand the nature of online activism is that denial of service attacks aren't the same as stealing private information. Okay? Denial of service attacks generally take place only from the outside. I posit, and every opportunity, I raise the point that theft of personal of information, proprietary information from within a company or government organization suggests to me that there's probably an insider helping them out. That's not a simple case of somebody in their hotel room or their dorm room hacking in and stealing something. Not unheard of. It does happen. But the vast majority of these incidents, I believe, occur with the help from somebody on the inside who may or may not be a supporter of Anonymous or a given online collective. If indeed a given incident of online activism, whatever involves proprietary or theft of data, okay, that then raises the question of, well, what can we do about it? I mean, if a website goes offline, yes, it's annoying, it's a nuisance, but we can deal with that generally. But how do we put the genie back in the bottle with information that's been extracted, been stolen from our private networks? Can we do it? Not really. It's very difficult to unring that bell, so to speak. So this raises the question in my mind of, well, where's the vulnerability here? What happened? How did this online collective group manage to steal this information? But point one, there's possibly an insider involved. But whether it's an insider involved or not, it raises the question of internal security controls and risk management. In other words, good cybersecurity. That's my concern. I then wonder, is this incident of proprietary information leaving a company the result of incompetence or complacency? And I point the fingers at the IT staff. But we can talk about that in the Q&A. So what can we do about it? We have two different types of attacks, two different modalities. We've got externally oriented denial of service type of attacks, and we have theft of intellectual property, theft of personal information from machines on the inside of our networks. What do we do about it? Well, in the case of externally oriented denial of service attacks, the answers haven't changed for the past 12 or 13 years. Back in 1999, when denial of service first came onto the internet security scene, I was part of a team that looked into, what do we do about it? This is going to be really bad. Some old-timers here might remember words like Trinu and Stackeldraht or Tribe Flood Net. These were early examples of denial of service attacks, and they scared us back in the late 90s. You know, could this shut down the internet? And in some parts, it did. So we developed a list of countermeasures to deal with denial of service attacks coming from the outside from groups like Anonymous or other online activist groups. Things like ensuring we have enough bandwidth available to give our legitimate internet traffic a chance to get through. If I'm Amazon.com, my bread and butter is the customer data coming into my web servers. If I can expand that internet pipe and add more capability, that may mean we get more bad stuff coming into us during an attack, but it also gives the good traffic a chance to get in. If I'm an e-commerce site, I'd rather have 20% of the revenue still coming in during an attack than no revenue coming in. So things like increasing your capacity, filtering, identifying traffic that's going in and out of your network to see, does it match a given pattern of a known attack tool, of a known denial of service tool, and then blocking it or working with internet providers upstream of you to disrupt and block and track these attacks. These countermeasures haven't changed. Strong internal controls in the case of intellectual property being extracted from an organization. Okay? And the best example of that is the Bradley Manning WikiLeaks scenario. How could one person in a tent around the world get access to this, what they call the treasure trove of data? One person. What risk controls were not in place or circumvented that allowed this insider to steal all this data? Internal controls, which really comes back to good risk management and good security planning and operations, you know, security competence. One of the things that challenges security folks in dealing with online activist type of events, denial of service or exfiltration of data, is the fact that these groups, as we just heard, are very resilient. And it's very difficult to block or prevent everything coming at us from these groups. When I was a child, when you go to a birthday party as a kid, you go to those arcades and they have the game Whack-A-Mole. You know, the game where you hit the mole pops up, you hit it, and then another mole pops up and you hit that one and another mole hit, right? That's what we're doing here as defenders. We're playing Whack-A-Mole. If you want to block every attacker coming at you, you're never going to win. You'll be playing a perpetual game of Whack-A-Mole, which illustrates the resiliency of these attack networks and their ability to survive even in the face of a strong defense. And it really becomes an order of scalability and capability. Very difficult to trade blows one for one with these types of distributed attacks around the world. You block this IP address from Russia, and it was replaced by another one from China, or one from Russia, or one from France. You're not going to win in a one-on-one bout with them. So the challenge for defenders is the pure technical resiliency of these online groups, let alone the social resiliency, the anonymity factors that Gabrielle talked about. Okay? You have these characteristics of the social aspect also applying to the technical aspects. Makes it much more challenging for us as the defenders to be effective. So why do we care? Well, if we are the victim of an online activism attack, we're involved as a victim. We are perhaps embarrassed. I run a great company, and our website was defaced in support of the protest of the Church of Scientology. Well, we have egg on our face for a day. Somebody reported to the media, there's some bad press about us. Okay. A nuisance, but not insurmountable. But we might care about that intangible reputation value. And if Anonymous could deface our website, could somebody else do something more devastating? And it raises all kinds of follow-on questions. There might be political ramifications. Again, you look at protests in support or against of the Arab Spring or Bradley Manning, WikiLeaks, or even just more recently, and I'm drawing a blank, the recent Russian elections. Okay? In the past 36 hours, people noticed that folks were on Twitter posting questions about the legitimacy of the recent Russian elections and Putin's legitimacy or any sort of misconduct, those tweets were suddenly swamped by tons of other tweets coming in and burying it in the Twitter universe, okay? A form of online activism being used to stifle dissenting opinion about political, real-world, physical, social change, social elections, okay? So we care about that because what does this mean for stifling political expression, if not freedom of expression more generally? So there are political ramifications for the leadership and a society. And, of course, loss of information. If you're running a company and you have intellectual property or war plans or cables that are extracted from your private networks, you have a loss of credibility. It raises questions, and it might make you a bigger target for another type of adversary because they realize if this one group was able to compromise and steal data, who else could? How good is your security, really? And I won't go into too many examples, but it's more of a concern than I think we care to admit to ourselves. Finally, I'd like to just leave one comment. Understanding the structure and the organization of Anonymous and groups like Anonymous is useful, as is understanding the technical way in which these groups operate and what we can do to defend ourselves or mitigate the consequences of any sort of incident arising from their existence in the world. But I also wonder if more attention should be given to their motivations for action, and rather than look outwards at them and blame them, whoever they might be, we also take a minute and look inwards to see, well, what are we doing that motivates and inspires these groups to action? If you look at the moral gray area that Gabrielle talked about, a lot of things that Anonymous has done in their doxing over the years, I think it's kind of cool, me personally. It's interesting to see things and get a different glimpse of the world. But that's a whole huge gray area. And we have to really wonder, well, why is this being kept secret to begin with? Again, I'll go back to the WikiLeaks, the Bradley Manning example. A cable was classified, made the front page of the New York Times, that said, Canada is a strong ally of the United States. A classified cable. You can find that, go into the CIA World Factbook, Wikipedia, take your pick. Okay? People saw that and they go, why is this classified? Which raised questions that maybe those in charge don't want asked. You know, do we overclassify too much information? Information may not want to be free, but are we restricting too much of it? All kinds of corollary issues get raised as a result of this fusion of social activism and technical capabilities that allows information to be disclosed and flow to make a political statement. So I'd like to close by simply wondering if, not just looking outwards at the adversary, but we also look inwards to see what are we doing that enables them in their day-to-day operations. Thank you.
I too want to join in thanking Alan for inviting me to come and speak with you here at Brookings. It's always a pleasure to come over here. I want to start by saying that I hope that I at least and everybody who considers this would approach this topic with a sense of great humility, which is to say that it's very, very difficult to talk about what to do about a problem when there's a huge arc of technological change going on. It's extremely difficult to think about the policies to approach a problem when there's a massive social change going on. It's doubly hard in a situation like the discussion we're having today about Anonymous and other hacktivist groups to make good judgments about what the right course of action is when the phenomenon that we're talking about is a product of a confluence of both massive technological changes in the Internet and massive social changes that it enables. So I offer the comments with some degree of trepidation and with a great deal of uncertainty about the right way to think about Anonymous generally. I love the title of this panel, you know, Hacktivism, Vigilantism, and Collective Action, because it spans the gamut of possible ways of thinking about groups like Anonymous. And the true answer is that in some instances it's hacktivism of a vicious sort, or vigilantism of an even more vicious sort, and in some instances it embodies collective action that has been a traditional core part of what we in America think of as free speech and political activity. I think one of the things that I start with in thinking about how to think about Anonymous is to think that in some ways groups like this are an inevitable consequence of the Internet. The Internet is this borderless domain that exists across sovereign borders in ways that are new and different and fundamental. It has built into its structure essentially an inherent bias towards anonymity. You can identify people within the domain of the Internet, but as a first-cut matter, that's not what the Internet is about, and so we tend to favor the ability to be anonymous on the Internet as an architectural matter, not as a political matter, but in the nature of the way that the Internet protocols operate and the switching system is built. It tends to enable action at a distance, right? Most of what we consider to be activity that we regulate in human nature is action in person, this speech. We have seen steadily the arc of technology permit action at a distance, television, radio sorts of things, and the Internet just is a quantum leap forward, a step function forward in the ability to be to act at a distance. It allows asymmetric action, right? In a world of conflict, it used to be, you know, who had the bigger guns wins the conflict, or who had the bigger voice wins the debate, wins the shouting match. In a world where every human being on the internet, all 2 billion of them, can download the low ion cannon and become a cyber warrior in, what's the download take, about 32 seconds, something like that? Yeah, that changes the dynamic of what power means in the context of the internet. And the final thing that really makes Anonymous a challenge, and what makes it almost impossible to distinguish between hacktivism, vigilantism, and collective action, is that on the internet, the information flows are indistinct. It's all ones and zeros, right? It would be as if in air power, we couldn't tell the difference between commercial planes, spy planes, and missiles that were coming across our aviation borders. Yet on the internet, by and large, it is difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish between normal commercial traffic coming to Amazon and a denial of service attack. You can, again, with difficulty, but those sorts of factors enable an anonymous, indistinct, at a distance, collective action attack of a sort that is completely different than anything we've seen. So in some ways, I tend to think of this type of group as an inevitable consequence of the very fundamental architecture of the internet. And then when you ask yourself, what should one do about it, at least the first order approximation is, should we do anything, right? Or is this just kind of the natural churn of this amazing borderless open communication system that has produced so much in the way of positive value to society? It enables Walmart and Amazon and banking online and getting the Guardian front page on your computer right now. I mean, there are all these sorts of things that are necessary portions of the internet that go under the rubric of internet freedom or internet commerce, any one of which is at risk systematically at risk, the more we tend to tamp down on communications because we fear the consequences of them. So one possible approach to this is to think that there's nothing that really needs to be done. We can do good hygiene on our own end, and, you know, just like everybody should get their flu vaccines, everybody should have a firewall program and an anti-intrusion program on their computer. But it may very well be that there's nothing that systematically a government ought to do about that. On the other hand, and if you buy that, then I can just sit down and we can stop this talk. I actually think that there's more to it than that. But for policymakers, at least those with some degree of humility, I would say before we enable a large set of massive changes of governmental policy and restructurings of the internet, we sort of think about whether or not that's truly necessary. Because I think the candid answer is that though Anonymous generates a great deal of fear and a great deal of media attention, the true scope of its of the harm that it has actually caused is relatively modest, certainly not existential, at least not yet. And perhaps you fear that they might become an existential threat down the road. But at least as a first approximation right now, it's kind of like crime, right? You can't eradicate it. You just kind of worry about it. You try and reduce it a little. But we're never going to reach a world in which there are zero murders. And I suspect that absent massive change, we will never reach a world in which there are zero anonymouses, period, full stop. So maybe we just live with it. What you decide to do about it, though, depends upon really which of these three buckets, hacktivism, vigilantism, or collective action, you think is the predominant value and which approach you should take. If you think this is a hacktivist group, kind of one that acts in a illegal manner as a way of either making a political point or stealing personal property, then to me, that assimilates sort of to an insurgency of some sort, right? It's not a criminal group so much as a group motivated by a philosophy of anonymity, and I would say also internet freedom and keeping sovereign control off of the internet, that looks a lot like, Mao in China, looks a lot like, the Viet Cong. If that's how you think of these types of groups, then the right approach is a good counterinsurgency strategy, right? It's not going out and burning down the hamlets and villages. We know that part of it doesn't work. But it's something like good intelligence, right? A public relations campaign that tries to diminish their influence and highlights those aspects of their interventions that are criminal, that hurt people, that are hypocritical, whatever their flaws might be, right? It's building capacity amongst people who would be resisting anonymous or other hacktivist-type attacks by spreading good cybersecurity practices around the globe so that you can't – I mean, the largest number of botnets in the world right now are in Africa, they say. Why? Because nobody there can really afford good cybersecurity practices, so the computers are really – well taken over. It gives us a broad domain within which to work, but that is one way of thinking about it. If you think that they're vigilantes, right, if you think that they're essentially criminal actors, right, then the answer is better enforcement of criminal law. That means more cooperation internationally amongst law enforcement authorities and using public relations and diplomatic tools to get other sovereign nations to participate more regularly in counter-criminal activity. The botnets that Anonymous rents are, a large number of them, are by and large owned by a group called the Russian Business Network, which is a massive criminal computer enterprise housed in Russia. The fact that Russia has been weak in choosing to go after that group for their own reasons, i.e. because the business network is sometimes at their service, as in the war against Georgia, that enables Anonymous by giving it access to a larger network of botnets. If we think of this as a vigilantism problem, then one of the tools that should be on the plate is diplomatic activity by the United States to get countries like Russia and China and other people who haven't taken strong action against the underlying botnet and illegal server activity that enables groups like Anonymous to act. That's another model. If, however, you think that this is a dominantly a collective action, public activism expression of a political viewpoint, then you've got a whole different kettle of fish. Then it's traditional First Amendment activity, right? I saw just yesterday that Anonymous posted a video opposing passage of the National Defense Authorization Act here in the United States on the grounds that it will authorize the detention of American citizens. Whether you think that's what the NDAA does or not, that's classic First Amendment speech and is the sort of thing that ought not to be suppressed in any way, manner, shape, or form. And it was with the Guy Fawkes mask and the big computer voice and even cited a friend of mine, as an authority. Then if it's a First Amendment sort of activity, the only thing you really need to do, the only thing that's legitimate is A, police the margins so that it doesn't trend over into criminal activity, and B, enforce the traditional First Amendment rules, things like preventing a heckler's veto so that one set of free speech doesn't drown out other parts of free speech. And that's a completely different model for activity within the government and portends a completely different sort of a policy and legal response to groups like Anonymous. So as I started at the beginning, with some humility, these are, three models of action, and I honestly am not sure which is the right course. I suspect that in the end it's a mix of them. For my own self, I tend to see predominant within Anonymous the more adverse parts of the activity. I see less of the political speech and more of the criminality in the interventions and the theft of private information. So I tend to lean in that direction, but I'm certainly willing to acknowledge that I might be wrong. And that kind of indeterminacy about what the true nature of the threat, if it's a threat at all, is, makes it very difficult, possibly impossible, for a coherent policy and legal approach to be developed to define what you should do to approach a group like Anonymous and its many co-actors. With that, I'll stop and turn over to questions. Do I just put it on? Is that all?
I think
I can do that.
I think you can. Yes. He may come by to make sure that we're properly recording, because we will be recording this to post a audio version and a transcript on the website soon. And usually I take the moderator's prerogative to ask questions, but I think we have a number of hands already shot up in the audience because there's a lot of provocative comments here. So I think we'll start with Ben over in the corner.
I don't think the mic is...
And there are mics passing around. Just a quick note on questions. Please, if you feel comfortable, identify yourself and where you're from. And as always, questions are relatively short and defined by the interrogative question mark at the end of the line.
So I'll actually stay anonymous. No, I'm kidding. I'm Ben Wittes from the Brookings Institution. Paul alluded to yesterday's video, or the video that I became aware of yesterday about the NDAA, which I actually think raises some issues that I'd love to hear all of the panelists talk about. But so one of the, when you're thinking about which basket to group this in, this sort of activity, and one of the things that has to be salient to that is the way they present themselves, right? And the use of the Guy Fawkes mask and the symbolism, so in this video, which has a speech by the guy in the Guy Fawkes mask that promises at the end some sort of action against the Senate on Guy Fawkes Day of next year. So Guy Fawkes, of course, is at the end of the day a guy who wanted to blow up the British Parliament. And so you have, so he's a terrorist, right? And you have a presentation that talks about some unspecified action against a legislative body on the anniversary of the execution of or capture of failure of the terrorist plot to blow up a different parliament building by somebody proudly wearing a mask. So a nefarious read of that would say, well, it sort of kind of looks like, you know, a group... guy with an Osama bin Laden mask talking about a September 11th action involving the Pentagon. Now, I don't actually read it that way, but I do think it raises the question of what the symbolism that the group is projecting about itself and what they're trying to say about themselves in relation to these various forms of action that Paul is sort of musing about. And so I'd be interested in all of your sense of, you know, how does their self-presentation affect the way they are and the way they should be understood by the larger public? Are they basically presenting themselves as speakers, or are they basically presenting themselves as sort of something more nefarious than that?
Start with the history of the...
So I'll give a little bit of background on why they use the mask, too, because it's just kind of interesting, and it goes back to this whole sort of way in which the contingent and the accidental creeps into this world, and then speak a little bit to, you know, the message they're trying to convey. On 4chan, a lot of memes are created. These are kind of catchphrases or images that are not simply viral. They're always under constant modification. And there's one meme called Epic Fail Guy. He's a failure. And one day he put on the mask. And so in 4chan, everyone knew about this mask because he put on the Guy Fawkes mask because, you know, of the popularity of the comic and the movie. And then when they had decided to, you know, fast forward, that was, I think, in 2006, fast forward to 2008, when they decide to protest the Church of Scientology sort of in earnest. They knew very well, which is actually a fact, that Scientology goes after its critics. And they're like, we must protect ourselves. And then they're like, well, where can we get cheap, accessible masks? And already the Guy Fawkes mask had been sort of in the air. And then they're like, ah, the Guy Fawkes mask, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, thousands of orders were put. And then it kind of stuck, in part because, you know, the very day of the protests, they circulated images and videos, like almost at the moment they were happening. And both because it is already a popular icon because of the movie, right? It has cultural kind of currency, as well as the fact that it was practical, as well as the fact that I think more than the kind of terrorist association, it signifies that importance of anonymity, just because the culture of 4chan is one in which you really are sublimating the individual in favor of, you know, the meme or the act. That, I would say, is one of the reasons why it stuck. So then in terms of what message they're trying to convey, I'll just be very brief. For every video that may be kind of sinister and scary, you can find a video which really seems to be, which not really seems to be, but is kind of parlaying, you know, a message of human rights activism and please help the people in Syria. That's actually the point, and I think that's why your presentation was so interesting, was like, which basket do we put it in? And the problem is you can't even separate the individuals. Some individuals may be engaging in all those different actions. Some don't. Mm-hmm. And then on one network, these multiple things are going on at once. And that's why it's such a kind of tough nut to crack.
Anyone want to join in briefly?
I would just say, from the operational perspective, if you have a public presence on the Internet, the Senate.gov, the webmaster, the U.S. Senate, the U.S. House, whomever, if you're a public figure, celebrity, you expect to be a target of some sort, whether it's the paparazzi in L.A. or, you know, an online activism group looking to deface your website if you come out in favor of something they're against. And that really comes down to, you expect it. I mean, the Secret Service expects there to be attacks or threats made against the president and the vice president. They're on guard for that. That's part of their job. They track down everything, every lead, and they follow them up. But there's a security bubble that works, a protective shield that works and in place. And if I was an operations person at the Senate, I would say, okay, let's be on guard for any suspicious network activity, any change in our baseline of normal operations. That might be a clue that something's going to happen. I would do a lot more sharing of information with my colleagues, my internet providers, to try to see if there's anything out of the ordinary. But I would treat that as the noise of being on the internet in that role that we are today.
So, Chris, in the front here.
Hi, my name is Chris Segoyan. I'm a fellow at the Open Society Foundations. So over the past few years, some simple-minded politicians would say that, you know, terrorists work in the Middle East are coming after us because they hate our freedom, which is, of course, stupid, although this line was trumpeted by our former president. But when you delve into the issues a little bit, you find out that there are legitimate beefs that they have. Stationing of troops in Saudi Arabia or actions in Israel. I mean, we can disagree over whether those are legitimate or not, but there are deeper reasons why people may want to try and blow up bombs here. I think Anonymous is the same. And in many ways, Anonymous is either the soul or the conscience of the Internet. And several of the actions that Anonymous has taken over the past few years have really struck a chord within me. And I'm going to say I sympathize with what Anonymous has done, but not the way in which they've done it. When Visa and MasterCard cut off donations to WikiLeaks, when Sony went after independent security researchers for revealing flaws in their system that Sony had long ignored, there have been several similar issues like this where Anonymous has really done something that no one else has done. Anonymous has stepped up because there was no one else to go and go after these activities. You know, whether or not you believe what Bradley Manning did was a good thing, I think many people are upset with what's been done since. And so, you know, Paul mentioned the idea of treating this as a counterinsurgency. And one of the techniques that you use when you want to stabilize things is you have this Hearts and Minds campaign. You go in and you build schools and libraries and you provide free healthcare and candy bars. And the Hearts and Minds campaign against Anonymous would be to stop doing stupid things to the Internet, right? So if we really want Anonymous, and I will wrap up and actually end in a question mark, but if we really want Anonymous to stop engaging in these kind of antics, wouldn't stopping things like SOPA be a good idea? Wouldn't stopping things removing the power of the copyright lobby and in fact, stopping the harassment of WikiLeaks seem to be a really good start? Thank you.
Paul?
First, it's great to finally have a face to go with the name, because we've been on the internet before, so now I know what you look like. I think you're right, in part. Here's the only piece of it that makes me a little skeptical of that story. I see Anonymous and groups like that going after the easy targets in the West, where they know that a rule of law prevents really adverse activity against them. I would have a greater confidence that that's the fundamental part of Anonymous if they were, you know, trying to break down the Great Chinese Firewall and bring internet freedom to the group of people who have the least amount.
In the Middle East.
In the Middle East, they've been active, though. Of course, their other action when they their act against the Mexican cartel, which would have been, I think, a great positive example that made that part of the meme. They withdrew. So when they use their power, I mean, and I take most of what you say to heart, but they tend to focus on people who are going to fight back only within this zone of acceptable fight back. They know, or they probably know, that we're not going to send assassination drones after them. Maybe they think they will. But so I would be a little more comfortable with that as the fundamental expression if they were more Catholic, small c Catholic, in their oppositional taste.
Bill, and then Rick?
I just want to make one point, which is we're talking about Anonymous as if it's Anonymous and then, you know, us out there. And the mediating factor is the media as well, who are very responsible, too, for kind of putting a spotlight on certain issues that then it gains steam. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Fair.
And so we're talking about as if they have intention and then, you know, we're supposed to interpret the intention. First of all, they're very good at kind of making intention hard to read. And then the media oftentimes is what kind of makes or breaks a certain sort of operation. And then I would say, actually, you know, for the whole month of January, the kind of interventions all over the Middle East and North Africa were really astounding, mm-hmm. you know. And that's the thing that's really hard to kind of interpret. But you have, like, basically a 16-year-old kid who started Optunisia January 2nd when the media was not paying any attention. And they were providing tools and helping them circulate videos out and making sure that they could protect themselves from death squads, you know. But, yes, that comes at the hands or right along with using tactics that are, you know, very profoundly discomforting at the same time.
I agree with your take about this being possibly viewed as an insurgency. And to your point about the hearts and minds, I think that the actions or antics, depending on your point of view, of groups like Anonymous does strike a chord in the hearts and minds of the public. Where the challenge is the public may embrace and support or quietly applaud a lot of their actions, but and or disclosures or things like that, but then the policymakers and the established figures in society, whether it's, you know, government or companies, they're obviously strongly against it. The media, not to be too conspiratorial, reports to their shareholders, and they're part of the power elite. So the hearts and minds, I think, the public is, I think, in this group's favor. The hearts and minds argument is being won slowly, but not by the folks that actually, you know, swing the pendulum with SOPA and things like that.
Thank you. So I think we have Michael in the middle of the back and then in the far back corner after that. Just a point on the media while she's getting back there. Prominent security writer declined to join us because he believes that they get too much attention. If we all just ignored them, they go away.
So I have a question for Professor Coleman, sort of a connection question. I'm afraid I'm going to have to do a bit of a 30-second preview to it. Kicking the Church of Scientology has been sort of the great hobby of the internet zeitgeist since about 1993. Before there was Chanology, there was Clambake, things of that nature. I mean, this has been going on for a really long time. So at the same time, in taking a look at, Richard mentioned Trinu and Stacheldraht, sort of the early DOS bots. When you take a look at Loic is, in comparison to, you know, the current generation of malware, almost laughably primitive. Mm-hmm. It doesn't anonymize. It doesn't spoof. It doesn't do things that we think of as traditional malware-type activities. So the thing I'm trying to figure out is sort of Anonymous's connections across time and in organizations. Did they, when they started Chainology, was this an outgrowth of things like Clambake, were they the older, grunty people, the internet involved in that? And at the same time, is there any actual indication of real connections with existing cybercrime organizations like the RBN or things like that? It's true that they can rent a botnet, but one of the things that I've seen, I mean, speaking from sort of the professional paranoid perspective, is that a lot of their software is written sort of in the assumption that they're not going to get caught doing anything. And so I'm just curious about the relationships then to e-crime, to the past history, things of that nature.
Great. Well, I'm glad you asked because, you know, it is kind of weird that I look at Anonymous and people want to know why it is and how I got to them. I study free software and hackers, and I was quite familiar with the Usenet protests just because I knew people who had engaged in those battles. And then for a year, I spent it at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, which happens to have the largest Scientology archives in the world housed in an old IKEA factory, and I felt like maybe was sending me a message that I should study this. And when I dove into it, I was like, oh, I see why geeks and hackers love to battle the Church of Scientology. It's their evil doppelganger, you know, the perfect nemesis. It's the bizarro comic world, right? It's extremely offensive because it's not simply religion, but one of science and technology that's false. And so I studied those Usenet era protests, and then lo and behold, and I thought it was sort of a thing of the past, and lo and behold, in 2008, this thing by the name of Anonymous emerges and starts to do it again. And I was like, oh, it confirms my perfect anthropological thesis. This is so wonderful. Ha, ha, ha. But it was such a niche kind of phenomena. And so definitely I used to, when I gave talks, would situate it in terms of that longer history. And yet what happened with Anonymous, I always thought it would kind of remain as kind of a trolling and then niche political boutique movement against the Church of Scientology. And on the one hand, it came as a great surprise when they started to kind of diversify their tactics politically, right? And so I kind of had to break away from just the Scientology dimension. So that's just a little bit of kind of background in terms of how I got there. In terms of that kind of criminal connection, you know, there was one article I once was upset at because it portrayed Anonymous as like criminals. And I was like, well, if they're a criminal, they would try to stay secret, because that's what criminals do. They don't be like, hey, come look at what I'm doing. Do they use criminal tactics? Do they turn to the RBN? Absolutely, some of them. You know, that's without a doubt. And some individuals within Anonymous, some really seem to be there just to kind of raise hell, because they like to DDoS. And then others are willing to kind of use criminal connections and tactics for political purposes. So those both do exist in there at the same time.
Paul, and then...
Yeah. I agree with you. I think in a lot of ways it's a lot like any other protest movement, right? There are a lot of people who are there just peaceful protest occupying space, right? Then there are some who trench upon a criminal law but aren't true criminals, say, oh, building a hard structure in the middle of McPherson Square without a permit, which gets you some real attention. And then there are people who kind of slipstream inside the group, maybe share its values, but who really like to go out and burn down buildings and break windows. And then they're the next group which come behind them and steal the TVs from outside. So one thing I think is fundamentally correct about what Gabriella said is that this is a multifaceted phenomenon, a very diverse group of people. Some of them are just in it for the lulls. Some of them like the lulls but are in it maybe to make some money. Some of them are in it to, everybody's got a motive. The challenge is that we run a risk of trying to pigeonhole them into this any one category. And it's not. It's not like China. You know what China is, right? You can figure out who the leader is. You can't figure out who the leader of Anonymous is.
Rick, have you seen anything on when and to the extent to which they use sort of malware and botnets?
The extent as far as the how frequent they use it?
How frequently they use it. And
I don't know how frequent they use it, but it, when you look at some of the large-scale events like the attacking Visa or MasterCard or PayPal, when you see a web server of that magnitude or web server farm of that magnitude get knocked offline, you know it's not two or three people using low LOIC. It's an army of probably zombied computers.
Yeah. There's a question in the back corner, then we'll come front.
Okay, so my name is Jen Whedon. I work at a cyber risk management firm. This question is mostly for Dr. Coleman, but I was wondering if you could speak to, I know it's hard to get into the demographics of the group, seeing as it's so fragmented.
And anonymous.
I also have had the misfortune of reading a lot of the IRC chats, and it's, to me, I could never reconcile some of their, you know, in the opportunities or whatever, I couldn't reconcile the political ideas behind the rampant misogyny and racism and complete incoherence of some of these actors. So I was wondering if you could speak to that. And secondly, I would disagree with everyone's characterization of the Russian Business Network. It was a bulletproof hosting provider that hasn't been in operation for a while. It's sort of become the internet's boogeyman for Russian organized crime. There are certainly actors who are associated with it who are still doing nasty stuff, but that's a separate issue if you want to talk about it afterwards. But
that's great. So demographics. I often say that I am, you know, walking in a labyrinth or a maze where I see kind of glimmers in the shadows, because I don't try to push anons too much to kind of reveal stuff about themselves or unmask themselves in the Anon Ops network. Some people do. I've met some. I, you know, talk to a lot. And what I will say is that on the one hand, you know, there's a kind of discourse among Anons, we are anyone, we are everyone, we're lawyers, we're doctors, we're DC policymakers. And on the one hand, you know, there is a kind of openness and it's kind of surprising, like some unusual characters, but I tend to say like they're geeks, you know, they're geeks and they're hackers. By geeks, you may not be as technically sophisticated, but you have kind of grown up on the internet, on message boards, gaming. These sorts of things. And yet, when you say geeks, oftentimes the problem with using a term like that is that it kind of conjures one image and one image alone, basement, pimples, you know, and psychological pathology. That is wrong. That is wrong. The people I have kind of encountered are remarkably diverse, from, you know, people who come from the 1% and are near royalty in Europe, to other folks that, you know, are below working class and have extremely unusual backgrounds. And in some ways, the people that have done illegal actions, you know, you could kind of apply Malcolm Gladwell's theory of outliers to them. They just have very unusual backgrounds, which may be one of the reasons why they're willing to go where they go, right? So geeks, hackers, but still a kind of tremendous diversity within that lot, from Silicon Valley engineers to those that are, you know, at the bottom of the barrel at some level. When it comes to that kind of world of misogyny, racism, that is part and parcel of 4chan, Encyclopedia Dramatica, not alone to Anonymous, it's an extremely kind of complicated question. I don't think it's just straightforwardly racism or not racism. It's kind of both at the same time, where they're kind of parroting existing stereotypes and magnifying them. And the purpose is to kind of shock. It's a little bit of equal opportunity shock, not entirely. And it doesn't always map on to reality. So just to give one last example, and there's a really amazing piece coming out in Triple Canopy, this journal that's all on what is anonymous culture, not the political wings, but on that kind of crazy world of irony and shock. Really look out for it. It's the best thing I've seen. But Anonops, where Optinesia happened, all these places, had a huge kind of queer community, you know? Like, at a certain point, I was like, oh, you guys are not joking about wanting each other's whatever, you know? And it took me a while because I was just like, oh, they're just being offensive. So it's not always what you think it is. Does that mean that we should just kind of embrace it? Not necessarily. But it's not just straightforward kind of racism and homophobia on these and these domains either.
I think We have time for one or two very quick questions. Marcus in the front here.
Mark Rash, CSC. I have a quick question. When we talk about concerted activity that leads to criminality, whether the activity itself is criminal or not, raises the question, how do we deal with that from a legal perspective? We're used to the idea of a conspiracy, where people get together, they agree to commit a crime, and then they go ahead and assign roles and people do it. But it seems to me that with Anonymous and other hacktivist groups or other types of loosely distributed groups, it's impossible to hold one person responsible for the actions of another, as well as impossible to hold the whole group responsible for the actions of a group. And I'm reminded of a time in Nixon's second inaugural when they had the national flush in. When he took the oath of office, everybody was supposed to flush their toilet at the same time, which would cause a dramatic drop in water pressure and all this destruction and havoc. One could argue that Nixon did that himself, causing destruction and havoc. But so how do we hold individuals responsible for the actions of the collective? How do we hold the collective responsible for the actions of individuals?
2 minutes.
Oh, that's a great legal question. It's one of the many horrible legal questions that attend. I would say, look, there are a couple of doctrines of law out there that we have used in the past that might apply. Thinking about. One is the doctrine of conscious parallelism. It comes from the antitrust field. It's where people coordinate their action not by actually talking to each other and making an agreement, but you see it in some people think illegally in airline prices. You know, Southwest lowers its price and then they wait to see if people will parallel them. If they do, raises its price, the price sticks. If they don't, you know, they quickly drop their price. So there's a doctrine of conscious parallelism. Extremely difficult to prove, very hard to use in a criminal context in particular, where in America, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The other one is we have a reasonable foreseeable doctrine. It's called the Pinkerton Doctrine, an old famous case in which you are liable for the things that are reasonably foreseeable as a consequence of the actions you've taken. At this juncture, I think that our understanding of what is reasonably foreseeable within the context of a group like Anonymous is far too indefinite for us to actually be able to apply that doctrine. But I also think that things like what Gabrielle is doing and our general experience over the next 10 years may well get us to a point where we can say with a degree of confidence that's good enough for a legal system that destruction of that website was a reasonably foreseeable consequence of your participating in this IRC chat or something of that nature. We're a long way from there. Right now, it's immune.
Rick,
as you were asking your question, I was thinking material support and questions about, well, if your computer was used from home in the conduct of defacing a website or part of a denial of service attack in support of Anonymous and the IP address is traced back to you, you had no idea. Did you? Did you not? So I wonder how long before we start seeing legislative language that talks about material support, wittingly or otherwise, in support of Anonymous and online activism.
So one very quick question, if there is one in the audience. Ryan?
My name is Ryan Biedisch, and I'm a fellow at the Berkman Center at Harvard. Perhaps maybe to try to end on a positive note, I was wondering whether there was any lessons that can be drawn from Anonymous, but in the sense that what they're doing is really impressive in some ways, in that it's an anonymous body that's coordinating action to accomplish certain tasks. And so I was wondering whether there are lessons about how that could be channeled, lessons about the structure of how it's set up, and that could be applied to other systems. In such ways that same kind of behavior could be used in other groups to accomplish positive things, or whether you believe that it's something inherent in the system that behavior will always sort of fall into all three of those buckets that you've been discussing, or whether there's a mechanism for channeling it into the more productive of the buckets.
What can the Tea Party learn from Anonymous?
I mean, on the one hand, you can say something like 4chan has created amazing cultural artifacts that are not offensive. They're internet memes, and so that's kind of a positive element to it. But it is definitely the case that I do think I really like to compare Debian, the largest free software project in the world, which I study very, very closely, which is, again, a kind of perfect inversion, though meeting at the middle there of Anonymous, because they have a social contract, a constitution, uber transparency. You have to sign each other's encryption keys. And so in some ways, for them to kind of collectively organize and scale to the degree that they have, you have to put in kind of procedures and policies and norms that Anonymous does not want to go there. And so I do think that part of the kind of flexibility and open-endedness and decentralized nature of Anonymous will always then make it so that it becomes very difficult to fully morally control what's going on at some level.
Cool. I think that one of the things we learn from Anonymous, which is really fascinating to me, is that there is this possibility of self-organizing groups. There's a theory about this by a Swedish economist named Einhorn. I'm going to write. And her theory is that these self-organizing groups can be sustained only over a limited amount of time, space, and distance, a cohesive group. The classic example of this is lobstermen in Maine, who without any need for any rules or regulations allocate the catch out of lobster pots, even though it's a common resource that they all could exploit to heck. But because they're a tight-knit social group, they've all lived there for 3,000 years, and your reputation is everything, they don't. She takes that and generalizes it to the fact that it can't be too much expanded beyond a group like that. I look at Anonymous, I see both that it started trying to do that, that it's had its breakups and groups of dissent groups breaking off and going away, and then some of them even fighting with the original groups and lots of conflicts. And I think that what we learn from them is that her theory is probably right, that it's a limiting factor. But one of the things it portends is the possibility that the internet may make it bigger and easier to do, and we'll have a larger time and space limit. I don't think it'll ever get to be like the grand internet democracy that everybody participates from everywhere all the time. I don't think it'll work for, what's that third way politics America thing that they're trying to do?
Americans elect,
that's it. Because I think that's probably too big, but it's a great social, leaving aside everything about whether what they do is good or bad, it's a great experiment in social organization that's really fun to watch.
The book is still being written on Anonymous, and I think if you look at Anonymous, as Paul said, it was born of the internet age. It reflects social activism in the modern information-based society. 10 years from now, we'll have a lot more lessons learned about how activism has evolved and jumped into the online world. And 20 years from now, we'll look back and you can see a definitive history of activism of the 60s in the physical world, the 70s, into the cyber world of the 90s, and where we're at now. So give it time. But I think it shows that how information technologies plus social activism concepts, it's opening a new chapter for us. I think it's going to be a very exciting couple of years ahead.
We need more anthropologists. Before thanking the panel, just a quick plug for those of you who are interested more in the specific question of botnets. Next Friday, we'll be having an event with the Department of Commerce and Department of Homeland Security on ISP role in botnet notification and takedown. But this was a fantastic discussion, and I think probably one of the more nuanced discussions on this phenomenon that Washington has seen. So I really want to thank Paul, Rick, and Biela, and I hope you'll join me.